Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the North Atlantic Right Whales conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct the question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during this conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Ms. Carol Gregory. Ms. Gregory, you may begin your conference.
Thank you very much. I want to welcome everyone who has joined us either by phone or those who are watching us live on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Carol Gregory with Conservation Law Foundation. I'll be moderating today's very important discussion. We're here today to talk about the North Atlantic right whale, which is facing a crisis that is putting a species that's already endangered at the brink of extinction. I don't think that's an over-exaggeration. Last year, 17 whales died out of a total population of barely 460, and so far this year, the end of the breeding season, we have seen no new calves. So it's pretty dire, unless we can reverse this trend. So we've got if there's anybody who can get to this and talk about some of those solutions, we have a great panel here today. I want to welcome Scott Krause, Vice President and Senior Advisor for the Anderson Cabot Center for Ocean Life of the New England Aquarium. This is an issue he knows very well. He's studied North Atlantic right whales for more than 30 years and is also the co-editor of a 2007 Harvard University press book on right whales. We also have with us renowned photojournalist and diver Brian Scarry. He's been working, not just a diver, but also bringing a lot of awareness to ocean issues during his 25-year career, was working for various folks, including National Geographic. And my colleague is here with us today also, Erica Fuller, who's the senior attorney with Conservation Law Foundation. She's worked to defend oceans throughout her legal career and is currently leading our CLS litigation on this issue. So, Brian, I want to start with you because right whales are very rare that you actually get to see one, and most of us here have never actually seen a right whale. Tell me about you have in your diving. What are they like, and how do they differ from other whales?
Sure. Well, you know, I did a story about right whales. It was actually published in National Geographic 10 years ago in 2008. And the concept of the story was to sort of compare and contrast two populations, the beleaguered North Atlantic right whale with their southern cousins, the southern right whales. You know, both species were hunted to the brink of extinction, but the southern right whales have recovered quite a bit better. They're still endangered, but because they live further away from industrialization, they have been able to repopulate a little bit greater. The North Atlantic right whale, as you just pointed out, are among, if not the most endangered large whale on the planet. So I spent over a year working with Scott and his team in the North Atlantic from the Bay of Fundy, Canada, to Florida, documenting those animals. I wasn't allowed to get in the water with them, and in most places where they hang out, the visibility wouldn't have been so good. But I did get in the water with southern right whales in New Zealand, in the subantarctic of New Zealand. And, you know, it should be pointed out also that both species are almost identical morphologically. They look very similar. They could actually mate. They were separated by land masses and oceans moving a long time ago. So to answer your question, what it's like to be in the water or to encounter one of these animals is extraordinary. You know, I think in comparison to other whales, I see them from a physical standpoint of being a little bit more stout. They're very muscular. They're just like a bull, you know, a very solid animal. But their behavior, my experience with these animals in the subantarctic was that they were extremely curious about me. The first few days after arriving there, and Scott was on that trip, we were there together, I was diving alone because I didn't want anybody else in the water with me because I was afraid that even one more person might scare the whales. But they were extremely curious. You know, Scott and the other researchers sort of believed that those animals, which had only recently been discovered, had never seen a human before, and their natural behavior was to be curious. You know, I had several, maybe half a dozen on the first few days around me, and these are 45-foot, 70-ton whales that were just extremely curious. And I can only imagine that the North Atlantic right whales were the same, you know, centuries ago before they sort of learned maybe to be fearful. So they're a beautiful animal, a very strong-looking animal. Certainly, I think their musculature is superior maybe than other more lean whales. And but their personality and their behavior was one of great curiosity and a gentleness. You know, they could have easily squashed me like a bug on the bottom of the ocean, but obviously they didn't do that, and
wow.
They were just, you know, interested in being with me.
Scott, tell us a bit about, so what's happening right now? How do we get to this crisis?
Well, the North Atlantic right whale has been subject to a number of problems in the last 40 years or so that we've been looking at. Usually it's been low levels of entanglement and somewhat higher levels of collisions with ships. And ships, when they collide with the right whale, tend to win, so the whales are dying. But in 2008, the federal government and prior to that, the Canadian government both passed rules with regard to changing shipping lanes and ship speeds in different areas where right whales were. And so ship kills dropped off dramatically. However, at the same time, we've seen an expansion of fishing activity both in the United States and Canada. And these whales have been entangled in fishing gear at increasing rates across the board. Right now, 85% of the population has been entangled in fishing gear. And the recent data suggests that those entanglements have been detrimental to both the mortality and the reproduction in right whales. So what we've seen is that since 2010, we've seen a decline in the population, and most of it can be attributed to entanglements in fishing gear, about 85% of it. And what's happened is that we think that there's this perfect storm of events where animals are also starting to move around a lot more. Climate change has warmed up the Gulf of Maine faster than any other place in the North Atlantic. Right whales are looking for food in more places, and so the more they travel, the more they're likely they are to encounter fishing gear. And the other part of this is that as animals move offshore, if they get entangled and die, we don't detect them. And our long-term data set suggests that we're only detecting one in every three mortalities. So even though we think we're, you know, killing four or five whales a year, and last year we killed 17, the actual number of deaths is probably two to three times that.
Wow.
I just want to jump in for a second. I mean,
sure.
Scott made some interesting points there that we tend to, you know, just pass by. But to think about 85% of a species has been entangled in fishing gear. I mean, that's, to me, an astonishing number. You know, you're not talking about 5 or 10%.
Right.
You're talking about 85% of these animals have been or are entangled in some way and have scars, entanglement scars. And, you know,
that's good. I really want to get in because you talk about the entanglement, and I don't know that everybody understands what happens when a whale gets entangled in fishing gear. And Eric, I do want to get to you because I also want to talk about some of the solutions that are happening in Canada. But I just... as we're talking about this, what is that?
Well, we have very few records of watching animals get entangled, but when they do, what they seem to do is to roll. So if you think about a right whale as a boat, 50-foot boat, it's got one significant difference, and that is the propeller, or the tail, is 15 feet wide. So in many places along the coast, when a whale is swimming along, if it doesn't detect and avoid the rope, it's going to get the rope wrapped around its tail. And what they tend to do is to try to spin out of it. And what that does is make the problem worse. So ropes tend to wrap around flippers, through the mouth, and around the tail. And as the whale grows or as the rope chafes in, it actually cuts right into the whale. So it's a bad way to go.
And then you've got this animal that's often dragging all of that gear with them. So it's not only the rope that's around the body, the tail, the mouth, whatever, the pectoral fins, but he or she is now dragging this excessive weight of crab traps or lobster pots with them until perhaps they die, you know, that the lines cut into their body and create wounds and infection, and they can't swim efficiently, they can't dive, they can't feed. So it's this long, agonizing process until they die. You know, it's the welfare of these animals that I think, you know, we should be highlighting. And when you consider that 85% of an entire species is suffering from this, that's alarming. I mean,
and one thing I might add to that is that there's a sublethal effect, which is that when you are carrying all that gear around, it's like having a broken leg or something, right? Mm-hmm. It takes you a long time to recover from it. So your body condition actually diminishes. Mm-hmm. And in mammals, body condition is everything for reproduction. So what this is also doing in the sublethal effect, remember, 85% of the animals are entangled. That means probably 85% of the females, they can't get fat enough to reproduce. And so we're seeing this big decline in reproduction. It's partly climate, and it's partly entanglements.
Erica, you were getting ready to say something.
Oh, Scott just addressed.
Oh, okay.
I was
going to
bring it
up. Oh, okay.
We were talking about, I mean, it sounds pretty dire, but actually there are things, there are solutions where we can reverse this trend. And Canada has implemented some things. And Erica's wondering if you can talk a bit about that, what's happening in Canada.
Yeah, so for the people that aren't aware, a significant number of the deaths last year were due to the Canadian snow crab fishery. They use heavier gear and ropes. And so the Canadian government decided in late January to take its first measures, and it increased the amount of gear markings that were required. It required fishermen to report lost gear, and it also took some measures to get some of the lines out of the water. And then recently, 2 weeks ago, they implemented some mandatory speed restrictions in the areas where right whales are known to congregate. They decided to open the fishery 2 weeks earlier than it usually opens and close it sooner, hoping that the fishermen could get in there and get all the quota before the whales arrive. They also, the fishermen and the DFO work together to reduce the number, are going to work together to reduce the number of traps in that area. So they're taking a lot of measures that we feel like. They also increased the funding for aerial surveys and for disentanglement teams. So, and they have fishermen that are testing ropeless gear, 10 fishermen, I believe, testing ropeless gear this summer.
So wow.
They've taken a lot of action.
So how do we get some of that in the United States happening? Like, who's in charge? Like, how do we get stuff moving here?
So in the United States, the National Marine Fisheries Service is the agency that's in charge both of protecting right whales and in authorizing the commercial fisheries that use some of the gear that right whales are known to interact with. So that'd be lobster, crab, red crab, a lot of gillnet fisheries. The National Marine Fisheries Service has some tension between their two duties, both to protect right whales and authorize these fisheries. But the way that they authorize fisheries is to do a biological opinion on and look at the impacts of that fishery on endangered species. And in this case, the National Marine Fisheries Service has been using a biological opinion on the lobster fisheries that's dated back to 2014. And it has some flaws. It doesn't consider this new science that came out in 2017 that showed that this sublethal effect that Scott was just talking about, it also assumes that the population is increasing, which we now know it's not increasing. And so it's their obligation to ensure that there's not jeopardy to right whales from this fishery. And so we and other environmental groups instituted some lawsuits to try to see if we could.
Yeah, tell us a bit about that. Could you tell us a little bit about the lawsuit? What are we suing about?
Yeah, so our lawsuit, as well as some of the other groups, challenges the assumptions made in this biological opinion. And one of the things that we're seeking is for the National Marine Fisheries Service to take another look at the lobster fishery in the very near future. The regulation requires this look to be within 130 days, and although the service has initiated another review of the fishery, they haven't announced the date by which it would be completed, and we'd like to have a date certain by which this review would be finished and ensure that that fishery, among others, doesn't jeopardize right whales.
I do want to remind people that this is a conversation, and we are going to be opening up lines for Q&A, so we'll be letting you know how you can get on in the queue. And if you have questions, Instagram, Facebook, please just post your questions, and we'll be getting to them shortly. because I know a lot of people want to hear about, you know, what's happening and have a lot of questions about it. So when we talk about, like, who's in charge?
So the National Marine Fisheries Service is in charge.
I'm concerned. I want to know what I can do, and I want all of you to kind of weigh in on that.
No, I think as a public citizen, there's a lot we could do to raise awareness, ask questions, certainly bring the subject up when you're eating in a restaurant. I think that it's important to ask our legislators to increase the funding for testing of some of these gear, that these solutions are not all inexpensive, and gear markings would be much cheaper certainly than testing ropeless gear, but there's funding for aerial surveys, there's funding for disentanglement teams, there's funding for some of the technology. Asking our legislators to help in any way they can with that. I think for recreational boaters, there's an app they could put on their phone that would alert them to where right whales are. They could slow speeds down. We know that vessels less than 65 feet can kill right whales, so slowing down to less than 10 knots can be helpful.
Any other thoughts about that? Because I know people really do want to get involved, and how do we start raising awareness about this?
I would certainly defer to Scott on this, but as a storyteller, as a visual storyteller, I like to sort of frame these issues. The statistic of 85% of the population being entangled, I think, is something that we can get our head around. But I think it's also helpful to sort of understand where we are today from where things were at one time. And I was just chatting with Scott before this conference began about what the historical numbers of right whales might have looked like before whaling started to diminish their populations, and then now these anthropogenic stresses, you know, due to industrialization. And I think, Scott, the number you mentioned was that probably several centuries ago, maybe in the early 1600s, there might have been, was it 10,000?
Yeah.
So think about that. This is a population of these beautiful big megafauna in the ocean, a giant animal that grows to 45 or 50 feet in length, 70 tons. And in the not too distant past, I mean, a few centuries ago, there was maybe 10,000 of these animals swimming around in Cape Cod and in Canada and in Florida and up and down the eastern seaboard of North America. And today, we've got 460 or somewhere south of 500 animals. So we've gone from 10,000 down to a handful of animals. The handful of animals that remain, 85% of them are entangled with fishing gear, being struck by ships. They're not reproducing because of all of these stresses and all of these other things. And they very likely will go extinct in our lifetime, in a few decades or less, if something isn't done about them. So the points that were just made about what can be done in terms of, you know, speaking to legislators about creating funding for aerial surveys and disentanglement teams, mm-hmm. and you know, all these other political issues about getting commercial fishermen to use, perhaps not getting them to use, but hopefully they want to do the right thing, and they will use, you know, ropeless gear and some of these technologies that I think Scott can and certainly speak to Eric as well. But, you know, these are the facts as they're presented. I mean, we've got a population that has drastically been reduced, and there are some solutions. So, I mean, I'm not about the solutions, but I am about, you know, trying to frame that story so that we can get our heads around it, because I think when you see it in those terms, we have to ask ourselves, you know, are we going to simply bear witness to the destruction and the demise of this species, or are we going to choose to do something about it? Because those solutions can exist. We're not completely helpless here. We don't have to watch that happen.
Absolutely. Erica, I got a text from someone that wants to know, do you know the name of that app that you were mentioning? We can get it to later and post
it
on Facebook.
It's Whale Alert.
Oh, okay. Whale Alert app.
Okay.
Scott, talk a bit about, because, you know, I keep hearing about the ropeless gear. How, Is that something that, how long would it take to get that online? Is that feasible? How feasible is that as a solution?
Yeah, I think it's, we think that we have two alternatives to existing fishing gear. One thing that's happened over time, it's important to realize that over the last 20 years, ropes have steadily gotten stronger for the same diameter. So we moved from hemp to polypropylene to polyethylene and blended copolymers that are much more strong. So a 3/8 inch rope that was would break at 2,000 pounds 20 years ago now breaks at 4,300 pounds. And the other thing that's happened is that the fishery, especially the fixed gear pot fisheries, have expanded from nearshore coastal waters to offshore waters, sometimes going right out to the edge of the U.S. economic zone. And the same thing's happened in Canada. So the fisheries are more expansive. They're using heavier, stronger ropes. And that offshore gear in particular is much more dangerous because it's usually long strings of traps with very heavy rope. So our approach has been to look at the factors that kill whales. And it turns out that if you were to make reduced breaking strength ropes that were less than 1,700 pounds, then most of the whales that died in fishing gear over the last 10 years would not have died. And so the one approach, and we've been working with a group of fishermen in southern Massachusetts, and one of them, John Haviland, has invented a sleeve that actually is a 1,700-pound breaking strength sleeve, and you put it in the middle of your rope every 40 feet. And right now we have seven or eight guys in Massachusetts and New Hampshire test fishing that to see if it'll work. And I think that one thing that we need from our legislators is appropriate support for those guys to keep experimenting. And, you know, they want to keep their fishery viable, and we don't want to cause the extinction of a fishery at the expense of a whale, right? We want to keep the whale alive and the fishery alive. Mm-hmm. So the goal is to figure out ways these guys can fish and not kill whales. Now, for the offshore guys, it's much more difficult because that weaker rope can't haul up those traps. At least we don't think so because the gear is much heavier. However, those guys, because they have a lot of traps on a string, are much more, it's a much more operationally favorable condition for ropeless gear because you have less clogging, you have less density out there. There's not as much gear out there. It's just bigger and heavier. And so you could imagine people have been we have three or four engineers who have been experimenting with different things. It's not ready for prime time, but one can imagine that you have a trap that sits on the bottom at the end of a long string of traps. You drive your boat over it, and an acoustic signal releases an airbag in it, and it flies to the surface. You go over, pick it up, and all the rest of the string is attached to it. And that has a transponder on it as well, so that other fishermen coming along later can actually see where the trap is on the bottom and not set over the top of it. So the technology, when you think about the technology, we're still using technology that's 5,000 years old, ropes and traps, right? And we happen to live in a world where your average cell phone has all the power that you need to determine where your traps are on the bottom and probably to release them. And everybody has a cell phone. So this is not... It's a huge paradigm shift for the fishery, but it's not a technological challenge. This information is available and can do it. And so I think we need to encourage fishermen like the South Shore fishermen to really, you know, the guys in Massachusetts who are experimenting with this, we need to encourage fishermen like that all along the East Coast to try alternative gear types and really work with scientists to figure out the solutions to the problem.
I want to make sure I know that people are starting to populate with questions on Facebook, Instagram, and want to open up the people that are on the telephone, the lines, if our operator can just give instructions on how folks can get in the queue.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and then number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. To prevent any background noise, we ask you that you please place your line on mute once your question has been stated.
Thank you very much. So you guys get in there with your questions. We have a few that we've already received. One question, some people say the extinction of the North Atlantic right whale will have no adverse impact on the marine ecosystem. Can you please discuss its importance to that system and the planet? Anybody?
I'd be happy to tackle that one. We get this question a lot. A lot of people say, well, it's a foregone conclusion. It doesn't make any difference. So here's the deal. The oceans, every other breath you take come from the oceans. And those breaths, just remember that, half of all the oxygen you breathe comes from the ocean. And that comes from the plankton in the ocean. And the plankton in the ocean is dependent upon appropriate nutrients and so on. So here's the deal. Large whales are accidental farmers. What they do is they feed at depth, they come to the surface, and they poop. And they therefore transfer midwater and deep water nutrients to the surface, and that feeds plankton in incredible abundance. There's a lot, and I'm not just making this up, there's a huge number of scientific papers on the value of whales to large marine ecosystems. And in fact, there's a study in the Southern Hemisphere that shows, in fact, that blue whales actually promote healthy fisheries because of that transfer of nutrients. So when we start talking about one whale not making a difference, that might be true. But where you stop, you know, every whale is subject to the kind of threats that right whales are. And this is just happens to be the animal that's at the lowest numbers.
You know, and to that point, you know, I've spent 40 years exploring the world's oceans and telling stories photographically about those things that I've seen. And yeah, I'm a little slow, but it's taken me a long time to sort of come to the realization that everything matters, that, you know, nature, and I'm certainly not the first to say this, but nature is like the gears of a finely made clock or Swiss watch, where every single component is important. And you've got little gears spinning very fast and bigger gears turning slowly. But, you know, I've done stories about many different species of sharks and whales and seals and in polar environments and temperate water and tropical. And what I've seen in all of these places is that there's this harmony within nature that exists where everything sort of is interconnected and relies on each other. And as you begin to move and remove those gears from that machine, it begins to break down. And as Scott pointed out, if for no other reason than our own self-interest, it's important to have a healthy ocean. Our air comes from it. So, yeah, where do you draw the line? Certainly, a clear case can be made, direct evidence to big whales having a direct, you know, impact on, as Scott pointed out, productivity and plankton production and all of these things that are directly important to our own lives. But it's also a much bigger equation that we don't fully understand. And the question is, do we want to, you know, sort of surrender and say that well, it's too late, we can let these animals go and maybe we won't see the impact in our own lives, in our own lifetime? Or, you know, do we be proactive and take steps that exist to try to stop that destruction? Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're faced with.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Ernest Edwards with a question on the phone.
Your line's now open.
Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, we can.
Okay, I sent by Facebook four questions.
Okay.
I grew up in the 50s in the tributary of the Chesapeake Bay and saw what happened there. So ended up, my wife and I bought a peninsula on the Bay of Fundy to turn it over to preservation land, as well as we've been engaged in trying to protect the North Atlantic right whales up in Canada. We live in Massachusetts. The four questions, and you can take them whatever you want. What's the coordination that the governments are doing between Canada and the United States with regards to this issue? And are the NGOs linked up on this? And that's one question. Is CLF linked up with Canadian environmental groups? And what about a national North Atlantic right whale awareness day supported by Congress?
Well, I like that.
And why not tag NARWs and used for detailing in their behavior so that information can be used to correct the problems. With regards to the NARW Awareness Day, I had met with the environmental person for Kerry's office back in 2010, and they were interested. But I got kind of bogged down within, I was vice chair of the Massachusetts Sierra Club, and they have national organizations and committees, and it took about a year just of getting bogged down in their system. But it seemed, at least Kerry's
seems like there was some openness to it. Well, I want to make sure we don't forget the question, so let's go back. Let's see, Eric, I think you can answer some of this. One of the questions you had, and I appreciate all of your passion and your work in this area, was about CLF working with Canadian environmental groups, I think was one of the questions. And
I think his first question may have been whether the United States was coordinating with the Canadians and to our knowledge they are. We've been told at multiple meetings that the U.S. is taking this very seriously and coordinating with the Canadians. Some of those meetings aren't generally open to the public. I don't know if Scott's participated. I know there have been some groups of scientists that have coordinated and some regulators that have coordinated, but to our knowledge they are happening. It's just they're not open to the public, so I'm not the best person to report out. But
right.
I mean, the U.S. was very concerned about the Canadian snow crab fishery, and immediately the Canadians took action. So I'm sure that was in response to some pressure. As far as CLF's role in coordinating with Canadian ENGOs, we're just in the early stages of that now, but we would welcome any Canadian groups that might be on the line to reach out to us, and we plan to do more on that.
Yeah, and we often work in coalitions with groups on big issues like this, and on other ocean issues.
Right.
It's very important. Okay. And then going back to some questions coming in from, this is a good question. What is the impact of climate change on right whales? So we've talked a lot about the fishing gear entanglement, but what about a change in climate?
I think we don't actually know. We don't have the final answer to that question. We know that warming temperatures can change the developmental stages of their food, and that can create mismatches in the arrival times of both the food that they like to eat and the timing of the whales arriving. And so there's been, all we've seen is evidence that animals are moving around a lot more and staying in places less than they used to and moving to new places as well. And so we think that's related to climatology, but there's no smoking gun yet.
Right. Going back, and Ernest, I hope I got most of your questions in there, so feel free to log back on if we didn't answer all of them. Jessica Hathaway on the phone had a question. Jessica,
hi,
there?
I'm here. Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. my name is Jess Hathaway. I'm the editor of National Fisherman Magazine. So my question is referencing the industry. Given that the Maine Lobstermen's Association has long taken a leadership role in reducing right whale interactions among the lobster fleet, I'm wondering if you invited any of that organization's leadership to serve on the panel and provide some expertise from the commercial fishing industry.
You're seeing the panel right here, so this is our panel. Did you have a question? Was that the question?
Yes, I'm wondering if you were seeking expertise from the fishing industry, since that seems to be the primary piece of the conversation about interactions.
Well, we don't have the fishing industry on the panel today, but we certainly everyone here has worked in some way with the fishing industry and is quite aware of the issues and comments, et cetera.
I would just add that we would be we would like to hear from the fishing industry if they have solutions in mind that they think are workable and practical. We'd like to hear from them.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent my life on and off working with commercial fishermen. I have the greatest respect for their abilities and their resourcefulness. I've often said if I had to mount an expedition to the moon, I would probably hire commercial fishermen because they know how to get things done. Mm-hmm. So, having their input. But certainly there is that interaction going on. I mean, you're working with people and others are on new technology, new gear, breakaway lines and ropeless traps and all of this stuff. So, but yeah, obviously working with specific groups, Maine Lobstermen Association and those kinds of folks probably have great ideas or certainly a valuable voice in this equation, and that should be certainly listened to and made part of the process.
And really, I think that all of our scientists have been working with Maine Lobstermen's Association, the Mass Lobstermen's Association, the South Shore Fishermen, and other groups to try to find solutions to this for 20 years now. So it's not an attempt to exclude them. It's this is a different question.
Thank you so much, Jessica, for calling in. Going back to folks that are on Facebook and Instagram, the right whale population was rebounding with 39 calves born in 2009 until the year 2010. Then there was a gradual decline until zero births so far this year. Is it possible that the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, dumping millions of gallons of oil and a toxic chemical disbursement for over 3 months in April 2010, could be the root cause of the low birth count?
I guess I think that would be a stretch. I don't see any evidence for it. And the reason for that is that let's assume that all of that bad stuff came around the southern tip of Florida and was swept up in the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream leaves Cape Hatteras and goes due east. And right whales don't feed in the southern feeding grounds, so it's very unlikely that they would ingest any of that. So my guess is that that would be a very far stretch to link those two things.
But Scott, maybe you could maybe talk a little bit about the fact that right whales, in terms of reproduction during stressful times, sort of do shut down. I know Roz, your wife, talked about that as well as a whale expert and veterinarian. So maybe you could talk about in the lifespan of a long-lived animal, that's not necessarily a problem unless you're facing what we're facing right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, large mammals do have a compensation mechanism for stressful times. If the environment changes or if they're under unusual stresses from extrinsic factors, then they will they'll shut down reproduction for a period of time. But if you're a right whale and you reproduce for a period, normally for a period of 40 years, you can lose a few years and not worry about it. But for this population, the issue is that if they are going through a period of environmental stresses where they have to shut down reproduction, we have to stop killing them. Because you can't, if you were managing a herd of cows, you can't keep eating them if they're not reproducing. So.
Right. Okay, going back, are we going back to
the phone
now? David Dow had a question on the phone.
This is David Dow. I'm a retired scientist who lives on Cape Cod. I was wondering if any thought has been given to using commercial or fishermen or women or saltwater anglers to find out where the new feeding grounds are for North Atlantic right whales and also where the females may be giving birth.
It's a good question. There are various sighting networks around the East Coast, around the Western North Atlantic, but mostly, and we do get a lot of sightings from fishermen offshore. We've especially been getting a lot of sightings from the Mid-Atlantic, especially the saltwater fishermen on the continental shelf edge, which has surprised us. But the right whales are not. The thing about calving is that we're not missing calves. They're just not having them. So we could look all we want. We probably wouldn't find them.
This might be a good time to bring up a question that was asked earlier, which is why we don't satellite tag whales. And I hate to make Scott talk again because I think he's losing his voice.
No, I'm good.
Scott has a bit of a cold. Let me know if you need another hit of tea. We can certainly.
Yeah. That's okay. The thing about satellite tagging is that we have tagged we're up to about 75 different right whales over the last 30 years. The longest lived tag was about 3 months. I think we had two of those. The rest of them are mostly less than 2 weeks. And the satellite tagging generally is been shown to have some health effects, and so at this time we're advocating no satellite tagging until we figure out how to keep satellite tags attached. Right whales don't like to have things stuck in them, so they go to the bottom and they rub it off. And I've thrown thousands of dollars of water in, of technology into the water over the last 20 years doing that. So.
Okay, great. So we have another question coming from either Instagram or Facebook. How will trap marking reduce entanglement?
I can take that one and give Scott a break.
Rest Scott's voice for a minute.
And Scott can correct me if there's corrections to be made. But my understanding is that a number of the entanglement deaths, we don't have any idea what fishery, what country of origin, or, you know, that they come from. And so there have been efforts to mark the gear with a lot more specificity in order to identify where the gear had been placed in the water, what fishery it came from, and even the country of origin. So there's some scientific studies that show that if we were to mark gear every 40 feet along the line, that we would be able to identify about 95% of the entanglements, or 90% at 40 feet, and if we were to mark them every 12 feet, 95% of the entanglements. So right now, often whales will carry like 100 or more, 300 feet of line, and there won't be a single marking on it. There won't, if there's not a buoy, there's not any way to determine what fishery, whether it came from U.S. or Canada, or whether it was an offshore or an inshore fishery. And that's really important to understanding how we could do gear differently in order to decrease the number of entanglements.
Okay, thank you, Erica. And so let's go back to the phones now. We have Jay Miller. Are you still there?
I am still here. Can you hear me all right?
We can, loud and clear.
Thank you for this seminar. I'm former chair of the Sierra Club's Marine Wildlife and Habitat Committee when there was such a committee. And recently I asked the owner of a sizable fishing fleet in New Bedford, Massachusetts, what it would take for him to change his fishing gear on his dozen or so boats. From his answer, it seems that there must be some financial assistance or credit that will give the fishermen the opportunity or the incentive to make those changes. In today's political climate, it seems like a very heavy lift to get public funding for such measures, short of a change in the midterm elections. Oh, I didn't want to say that. But are there nonprofits or a source of private funding that you know of where we can incentivize the fishermen to make those changes when the technology has given us those tools and the new equipment?
I'm waiting for the phone calls to pour in.
Yeah. To that point, though, I would also ask, and it's an excellent point and good question, but I wonder, and I know Scott and I have talked about this, but might it not be possible to have consumers be willing to maybe pay a little bit more for lobster or crab or whatever it is if it's labeled as right whale free? You know, I mean, it wasn't that long ago that tuna fleets were able to sort of do a different process, a different method of catching that was dolphin safe. And could we have a right whale safe product that compensates fishermen for the investment in you know, new gear? I don't know if that alone would do it. I think maybe it's probably, like many things, going to require a combined effort. So you get financial assistance or government funding and tax breaks and so forth, along with maybe an increased price or something. But, you know, as a consumer, not everyone's going to do this, but as a consumer, I would like to think that a fair number of people will opt, if they're in a position to do so, to pay a little bit more for a product that is known to be right whale free, let's say, and that, you know, they can vote with their pocketbook as to what they're choosing to buy and what they're not going to buy. So maybe that's not alone the answer, and it's a little bit simplistic, but I do think that that's something that is worth considering.
Great. I'm going to go back to folks that are posting questions on Instagram or Facebook. Is there any genetic difference between the abundant right whale to the south and the North Atlantic right whale?
Yeah,
but they, but technically, I mean, they could mate, right? I mean, they're not so genetically different that
probably.
Yeah, but it, but there is
be
some
hard be hard.
How to get them together? But if we could get them through the canal, but
yeah, so, I think there's a, I think there are now six identified matrilines in the North Atlantic, and I think there's 30 or 40 or so in the Southern Hemisphere populations.
Okay.
But a lot more genetic diversity in the South, but not it's not. It's not a fatal situation in the north.
Right.
That's not a factor.
Hmm. Okay, great. Going back to the phones, we have a question from Andrew Pershing.
Hi, thanks. This is a great panel. So Portland Press Herald published a story yesterday on right whales. As you imagine, it's a big deal up here in Maine with given the size of the lobster fishery. Maine lobstermen will say that that they've never seen a right whale, and then Pat Kelleher from Maine DMR was quoted in the paper saying that there's no evidence that, that Maine lobster gear has ever been found in an entangled whale. I'm just curious to hear your response to that, especially in light of the statistic that 85% of whales have encountered gear.
Thank you, Andrew. I can take that question. I did read the article and appreciate Mr. Kelleher's point of view. I think that, you know, although in the last 2 years we can't tie one of these deaths directly to the American lobster fishery, we know that the historical interactions between this fishery and right whales is significant. And the biological opinion that I was discussing earlier, you know, the National Marine Fisheries Service assumes that this fishery may take up to 3.25 whales a year. So that's too high to be sustainable right now, and it's sort of an all hands on deck situation. I don't think anyone is targeting one fishery over another. It's just we need to start taking every action we can take to protect these animals before it's too late.
I will say that there are multiple records of entanglements in Maine fishing gear over the last 20 years. So it's not, you know, I know there's a lot of denial in the industry about this. The other thing that's important to realize is that there are lots of sighting records along the Maine coast and offshore in areas where some of the offshore Maine fishermen work. And so the probability of entanglement is high, the probability of detection is low, and I absolutely believe all the fishermen when they say we've never seen a right whale, because generally they're doing their jobs, they're not looking for them, and, you know, it's not a common event. This is a classic endangered species problem where if you're a whale, your probability of encountering fishing gear at least once in your life is 83 or 85%. It's actually the probability that you're going to encounter it twice in your life or more is almost 60%. But the probability of seeing a right whale in, say, within 30 miles of Maine is extremely low because there are so few of them. So the fishermen are correct when they say they don't see right whales, and the whales are, their experience is quite different.
Okay, and I'll have time for a few more questions here. Coming back to the Facebook, Instagram community, I think folks were holding out hope that maybe the calves were somewhere else and that maybe because of warming conditions or other factors, they just weren't seen. Scott is just saying that the whales just aren't having calves. Can you explain, please, how you know so we can communicate that to others?
Well, we have there are a number of surveys up and down the East Coast that are ongoing, and in fact, we run one off the southern coast of Massachusetts and Rhode Island in the wind energy area. The Center for Coastal Studies flies in the Cape Cod Bay and surrounding regions, and the Georgia Department of Natural Resources and folks down there, Sea to Shore, and so on, have been flying surveys over the calving ground and north and south of there for a very, you know, for the last 4 or 5 months. It is conceivable that there are maybe one or two females that escaped our attention, but generally the numbers of animals that are seen in all these other areas represent probably half of the population, and very, you know, we're just not seeing any calves. you would expect to see if you had a normal calving year. This year we would expect to see on the order of 30 calves. And the absence of calves in all the areas where people have surveyed suggests that there just aren't any.
Okay, we're going to go back to the phones now. And Patrice McCarron, if I pronounced your name correctly.
Thanks for taking my call. I am the executive director of the Maine Lobstermen's Association, so I appreciate the opportunity to be on today. One of the things that the panel hasn't mentioned at all is that we actually have a pretty comprehensive whale plan in place already. We've had a whale plan in place actually since 1997, and we do a variety of things to make our fisheries safer for whales. We don't allow any float line at the surface. We have wake links under our buoys to help whales get away. We've actually removed 27,000 miles of floating ground lines from the ocean. We've removed almost 3,000 miles of vertical lines. So we've done quite a bit. So when we talk about the plan that Canada has coming online, we all agree that that's fantastic and that needs to happen. But in the U.S., all fisheries are managed from Maine to Florida. And in Canada, they're talking about managing one fishery for a few months a year.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you, Patrice, for calling in.
If I could just ask Scott to clarify on a second point, you guys have talked a lot about the fact that 85% of right whales are entangled. If I understand that data correctly, that's an encounter rate. So those are whales that have scars on them, and 78% of those are very, very minor injuries. And it's actually only 6% that are severe injuries, which are really the serious injuries and mortalities that we need to be aggressive in preventing at this point in time.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think as we've talked before, I think that the smaller inshore gear is probably less of a problem than the offshore gear, and that the serious injuries are the ones that we really have to work on first. I do think that there has been a lot of work on the part of the Maine Lobstermen's Association and the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association as well to reduce entanglements over the last 20 years. The problem that that we're seeing is that there does not seem to be an inflection point in the rate of entanglements over time. As Patrice points out, most of those entanglements are minor. But the fact that they get entangled multiple times actually adds to some of the stressors. So we're not devoid of hope on this topic. And I think that we do have willing partners in the fishing industry, but we are facing a point that we really have to step up here. One thing that Patrice pointed out that's really important is that in addition to the crab fishery and the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which caught all the attention this year, there is a very extensive lobster fishery around all the maritime provinces, and we have yet to really understand how much of that gear is responsible for these entanglements.
Okay, we're getting to the end of the hour now, so no time for any more questions, but wondering if you all each had some last thoughts for everyone, especially in terms of how people can get involved.
Well, I think that there's a tendency for people to give up hope on something like this, and a lot of people have said to me, "Well, why don't we just let them go?" And my feeling about that is, no, there's no hope. There's no reason for pessimism here. These animals will recover and reproduce again, and they will have more of them. We just have to stop killing them in the meantime. I do think that this is a potential point of allegiance for both NGOs and the fishing communities is that there needs to be kind of a Manhattan Project to figure out how we can keep fishermen fishing without killing whales. And that's something that we could work on Congress for.
Yeah, and I would just add to that by saying that, you know, people have busy lives. And the first step in solving a problem is recognizing that you have a problem. And, you know, I think a lot of folks that maybe lived in New England their whole lives or on the Eastern Seaboard, many of them probably don't even know what a right whale is or that they exist. But to the degree that we can help tell that story. I think we should, about these amazing animals that were once at 10,000 population and today they're at less than 500. They're dying because of anthropogenic stresses that can be solved, and that it's not about pointing fingers. It's about collaboration and trying to figure out, do we, A, want to see these animals live? And then if we agree that we do, then it is about a Manhattan Project type effort that's going to be necessary to make that happen. But there has to be sort of that grassroots will from the people to want it, and from the legislative level down, and everybody working together to come up with solutions, and all voices are welcome. And it's a story that can have a happy ending if we choose to go in that direction.
Well, there's not a lot to add to what both of these guys have said, but I guess you know, it is on the theme of collaboration. It is an opportunity for technology to really take a role in changing fisheries, where, you know, for a long time we have been fishing with the same gear, and it's opportunity for all sides to participate in finding a solution, because we can recover the species, and they've recovered before, and we just need money and the right will.
Well, I want to thank everybody here today. Scott Krauss, New England, here with your cold, the New England program. And I know that you're going to be at the Harvard Museum of Natural History next Thursday, April 19th, talking about the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, another issue that CLF is very involved in. Brian Scarry, where are you off to next? Is there a story?
I'm off to
next?
The Caribbean for more whales,
okay.
Sperm whales this time. Yeah. Oh, sure.
And Erica Fuller, our senior attorney, who will be taking the next step in our litigation coming up, and to stay engaged with what CLF is doing, please visit CLF.org and sign up for CLF Action Alerts and e-news and Erica's blogs and keep up with what's going on. So thank you, everyone who joined us, Instagram, Facebook, on the telephone. Greatly appreciate it, and stay engaged.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.